H. Gombrich's 1950 book, The Story of Art, is one of art history's seminal texts. It's sold over 8 million copies and been translated into 30 languages. But it has one major issue. The first edition didn't include any women artists. Now on edition 6, it includes just one. Kette Kollwitz, art historian, podcaster and curator Katie Hessel is on a mission to correct that. Her book, The Story of Art Without Men, re-examines art movements from the Renaissance to today, focusing on the achievements of women artists, artists who have often been neglected and overlooked in favour of their male counterparts, those who have been innovators, who have been at the forefront, if not the first, in entire art history eras. Katie's also the curator, behind the popular Instagram account The Great Woman Artists. She's with us ahead of an appearance at the Auckland Writers Festival in May. Katie, thank you very much. Great to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Catherine. How are you doing?
I'm great. So the copy of the book I have is The Story of Art and Barely Readable is Without Men. And this is your way of literally rewriting a seminal text, Katie, that had a few gaps in it, shall we say.
Yes, I mean, it's, you know, I grew up reading The Story of Art and I loved it and I pored over it. It's the most gorgeous book full of images. It tells you the story of art in such beautiful prose. And really, if you sort of have heard of that word impressionism or you've heard of that word Baroque, you can look it up there and you can get this picture. And that's what I loved about it. And then when I was about 23 or so, I was invited by Tate, which is a major gallery in London, to install a timeline of the last 1,000 years of women artists that was 10 metres high, as you do. And I went to my Gombrich copy and I flicked the timeline at the back and I looked up where the women artists were and I realised that he hadn't included a single one, as you rightly say, until his 16th edition, where he includes just one, that being Kette Kollwitz, the great, great German expressionist printmaker. And I was really quite taken aback because in a way I felt like I'd been cheated. You know, I loved this book and actually I didn't feel like, I also felt ashamed myself that I'd never noticed it. And so I'd already begun the Instagram, I'd already begun the podcast. And so really it sort of came from, where do I take this to the next dimension? You know, books are around forever. I want to rewrite this book because women were always there. They always existed. It's just the fact that the gatekeepers have always prioritised one section in society.
What's striking is that you hadn't noticed until the Tate asked you the absence. And that's part of the, insidiousness of this in a way, whether it's science or history or art, is that we don't even necessarily notice the absence until we really have to look.
Totally. It's about, you know, I'd grown up thinking, okay, I've accepted this is the default. I've accepted the fact that in London, 1% of the collection is dedicated to women. That is not good enough whatsoever. We need to have gender parity in the art world, because if we're not seeing art by a wide range of people, then we're not seeing society as a whole. Art history is the history of the world through an individual's lens, that they are able to somehow create something visually that allows us to understand their life, the way they lived, what story they want to tell. And like I said, we need these records from an array of people. Otherwise, we're just missing out on great art.
This is a contemporary problem. A 2019 survey finding 87% of the art in major US museums was by men and 85% white artists. This is not necessarily a historical matter at all. And there was another book published by or written by Kate Moss, more statues of men named John than there are of women. Let's celebrate some of the women in the book. Well, first explain, how did you go about a massive task by any measure of finding the women and then doing indeed what Gombrich did, making the case for their influence on various eras of art history. How did you even begin, Katie?
I mean, the thing is that when I look at a book like even my book, I see a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the women artists who have contributed to art history. So already, I already think I'm, you know, cutting so much. I always say this is not a definitive art history. It's just what I've learned so far in my life. And you know, I'm coming to New Zealand for the first time in May, and I can't wait to learn more about the artists from your country and Australia as well. But it's about, you know, taking on this task and saying this needs to be rewritten. I want to write that book that my 16-year-old self would have loved to have read, because what I want this book to do is invite everyone into this subject. And perhaps someone who's never even stepped inside a museum will feel like they are welcome into this subject. That's really what it's about. It's about everyone for any level of art history. And the way I began was just saying, okay, well, you know, I know these terms. We've got the Renaissance, we've got the Baroque, we've got the neoclassical period. Let's kind of piece together a timeline of what I learned at university, which is the last 500 years of art history, except it was without men. And so it all sort of also came about because I started this Instagram account when I was 21 years old, after I had been studying women artists, or sorry, after I'd been studying art history at university. And I was at an art fair and I looked around me at all the artworks in this fair, and I realized I hadn't seen a single one by a woman. And then I had to ask myself, could I name 20 women artists off the top of my head? Could I name 10 pre-1900, any pre-1800? And the answer was no. What I realized is that I had been looking at the history of patriarchy instead of the history of art, and how the museums are feeding me a story that is actually skewed and not fair, because it was such fun researching this book, because there are so many incredible women who also had to work so much harder. You know, today there's an excellent exhibition at the Royal Academy of Arts, which is a kind of major museum here in London. The first ever exhibition that they've dedicated to a woman artist working pre-19th century, that being Angelica Kauffman. And she didn't even have access to the life room. She was around in the second half of the 1700s. And the fact that she had to sort of go around and find these clever ways to formulate that education that she was so often excluded from, but make her mark in history and tell those stories from a feminine point of view, I think is extraordinary. And, you know, I mean, this book is a party. It's a celebration of all these people who came before us. And I really hope that someone will just find one work in that book that resonates with them.
Let's talk a little bit more about her, Angelica Kauffman. She was one of those who founded the Royal Academy some 256 years ago, I think it was.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, what were they up against? There's wonderful insights in this. You know, the portrait of the founders, her and another woman, reduced to small busts decorating the room behind the male founders. And this is repeated on and on, isn't it? Just a constant kind of minimization.
Exactly. I mean, Catherine, you pointed out this fantastic work by Johann Zoffany of the 36 founding members of the Royal Academy. And it's this extraordinary painting where you see everyone's in a life room, the anatomy room. They're all crowded around a nude figure. And all these men are in suits and they're kind of analysing it. And actually, if you look closely at the front, there's a man who's got his spear on the torso of a Venus sculpture, which, you know, has all sorts of connotations with it, this idea of power and control and everything and objectifying the female body. And then if you look closely up in the right-hand corner, you see two portrait busts, which are barely visible, of Angelica Kauffman and Mary Moser. And this work showed them that they were banned from the life room. Not only would they be banned from the life room in 1768, but it would take until the 1890s for women at the Royal Academy to be admitted to the life room, where they could study the nude figure from flesh, this basic training for artists. And it would take until 1936 for the first ever female Royal Academician to be elected, that being Laura Knight. And so, you know, they were constantly at a hindrance. But when you look at Angelica Kauffman's paintings, she's painting famous mythological and historical women like Cleopatra or Circe, and she's painting them from a female point of view. And what I realize is that when I look at these characters, I've only ever been fed one narrative. And actually, when we look at artwork by a wide range of people, these narratives expand our mind and they show us so many different perspectives, which can also teach us us about how we read news stories and images we see in the media as well.
Let's learn some more then about some of them and how to pick them. I know the book's chronological, starting around 500 years ago during the Renaissance, as you said, your study covers that era. Let's look at the number of firsts and pioneers that were women and are now getting that acknowledgement. Who are one or two you would name?
Oh my goodness. I mean, so many. There were so many firsts. I mean, I want to, you know, shout out, this book goes all around the world. And one of my favorite moments is the Harlem Renaissance chapter in the sort of 1930s and 1920s in New York City, the sort of epicenter of Black cultural creativity. And there was this extraordinary artist called Augusta Savage. And she was just as much as an educator and a gallerist. She owned the first ever commercial gallery that was dedicated to Black artists. She founded the Harlem Cultural Art Center, which raised the next generation of artists such as Gwendolyn Knight and Jacob Lawrence, artists who would go on to be instrumental in the 20th century. But she also, through her work being a sculptor, making portrait busts and life-size figures of local people and scholars as well, and wrote an African-American story into art history. And even though she worked with plaster casts, she used shoe polish for a bronze effect in her work. And I love the fact that it doesn't matter whatever resource you have around you, you can make something beautiful, no matter what it costs. And in 1939, she had her big break. She was commissioned to make a sculpture that commemorated the contributions to music by African American people. And so she made this work, which essentially is like a harp, and it's of choristers in the palm of God's hand. And it was 16 foot high. It was placed in the center of the World's Fair in New York City, and it earned her major national press coverage. But afterwards, when the fair had finished, it was destroyed because of the lack of storage and funding costs. And, you know, a work like this is such a... It's stolen from us, really, because could you imagine the effect that a 16-foot-high work that shows the contribution of African Americans to people in the 20th century and now would have on them? And so it's about saying that these stories matter. You know, one of my favorite artists is an American portraitist called Alice Neal, and she worked from the 30s right up until the 80s. And she painted people from all walks of life. She called herself a collector of souls, and she painted Andy Warhol, but she also painted her taxi driver and her landlord's son and her cleaner. And the reason why she inspires me so much is because she painted the world for what it was. And she painted the people who lived and shaped a 20th century New York City. Because when we think about the history of portraiture, it's not just the kings and queens and aristocracy who have shaped the world. It's everyone. And so everyone's stories deserve to be in art history, I think.
One of the other things that the structure of the book highlights is how many firsts have potentially been misattributed to men. Let's talk about Hilma af Klint's, because there was a recent wonderful exhibition here just within the last couple of years in New Zealand, doing abstraction well before some of the other better known male names, perhaps. Could you just tell us a little more of her story? And then if we are going to correct the firsts, what would it read?
I mean, you know, this idea of first, this idea of misattribution and scandal is rife throughout art history as well. I mean, there's a great case for an artist from the 1800s whose work was thought to be David and bought for the Met for $200,000 in 1917 and then was rightly attributed to her, Marie-Denis Vier. But you're talking about Hilma af Klint, who was born in the 1860s in Europe. And, you know, she was one of the first ever artists in the second half of the 19th century to be able to study at sort of state-funded educations in Stockholm. And, you know, throughout her life, people thought that she was a sort of portrait and landscape artist working this quite impressionist style with these kind of brash brushstrokes. And in the 1890s and 1880s, she began to work in secret with a group named The Five. And what they did was they worked through seances. So they communicated with the dead or the higher spirits while they made their work. And as a result, they created these works that were these abstract shapes and flurries of automatic drawing. And they had symbols for every single color or every single motif that they used. And in the 1890s, she got a sort of call from a spirit named Amaliel for a special commission to show humanity the matter of the spiritual realm. And their five warned her that, too much close contact with the spirits could end up in madness. But she did it anyway. And she made this extraordinary series called The Paintings for the Temple, which she began in 1906. And they really are the first moments of abstraction in the Western world, when we think about her contemporaries such as Kandinsky or Malevich. And she died almost unknown. She only exhibited these paintings once, and she died in the 1940s. And she said in her will that no one could look at her paintings until 20 years after she died. And in the 1980s, actually, was she included in a show on spiritualism at LACMA. And in 2018, 2019, she had her first ever posthumous solo exhibition in the US at the Guggenheim. And not only did in the 1930s she draw this spiral-like temple that she saw to once to house her paintings one day, but this exhibition broke attendance records. Over 600,000 people came. It was an absolute revelation. And what I love most about it is the fact that it was called Hilma af Klint, Paintings for the Future. And how lucky are we that we get to experience these works, that maybe she had some kind of epiphany that it was for us, and we understand her and we treat her rightly. And I'm so glad that show came to New Zealand, because it has gone all around the world. And she totally deserves to be up there as one of the founding people of abstraction.
60,000 people went to see it here, which is quite a number for any art exhibition in a small country like this. Of course, not only does the book tell the stories, but we have the images as well, covering 500 years of art. Did you ever see a point where things began to turn? Or has it taken deliberate kind of decisions by the likes of the Tate to even recently begin to get something like a balance of recognition? Was there any point in the course of your scholarship for this where you saw the balance beginning to turn?
I mean, the thing is, it's so interesting because women artists have always existed. And also, I'm standing on the shoulders of so many people who have come before me, who have fought for these stories to be remembered. And I feel so lucky that I'm living in 2024 at a time when women, for the first time, have taken the helm of the Tate, the Louvre, the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., these major museums that have the power to shift what we think of and know of as the canon of art history. And, every period was groundbreaking. That's the thing. I mean, what was remarkable about the 1970s, though, was this was a time of sort of feminist reckoning, the second wave feminism. And what was amazing about that period was it was about coming together and community and exhibiting each other and exhibiting women artists in a space together and acknowledging, 400 years of feminist art history. There's a fantastic scholar called Linda Nochlin, who sadly died now. She died in 2017. But in 1971, she wrote an essay called Why Have There Been No Great Women Artists? And that's the name that my podcast and my Instagram cite, The Great Women Artists, because I sort of want to kind of almost answer her as a sort of, me being from a different generation and everything. And what was amazing about that period was, before then, there was no course on queer art, on feminist art, on African American art in universities. And so this was a time when that education shift, and actually, it's thanks to those teachers who have come before me, who have done that work and taught the next generation. So people like me, who was born in the 90s, who can actually say, I'm so grateful for these books that have been written, because they have changed the landscape, and education is everything, I think.
The Instagram page has a big following, 400,000 the last time we looked. You started in 2015. It's a heck of a lot of work, but what is the potency of this contemporary way of experiencing and discussing art, not standing around necessarily in a museum or a gallery, you know, with a quizzical, poised look, but this very democratic, if you like, and immediate way of sharing art.
Totally. You know, I started this Instagram when I was 21. I've now just turned 30, so I've been doing it for 9 years. But it was really a way to interweave art history with people's daily life and to say, you know, everyone can be part of this. And also, I was 21. I didn't have a gallery to have an exhibition in or a newspaper column or a book deal. You know, it was what I had in my reach. And, you know, I had to work. I had a full-time job. And so Instagram was a way of me to keep up with my art history, but also to share it. And, you know, it was at this time where, you know, it was slightly pre-Me Too, and there was so much going on in 2015. I think a whole lot of like-mindedness amongst so many people saying, hang on a second, this needs to be addressed. And, you know, it's also about, you know, I'm a child of the 21st century in a way, and I want to write this book for, and my Instagram, it's for everyone. It's people who were born, you know, throughout the 20th century, but also kids who were born, you know, 14 years ago. And I want to say, if you've never stepped inside a museum, don't worry, you're welcome here, and this can be your starting point, and maybe you'll enter a museum one day. And perhaps this artist will show you something about the work that feels so familiar, yet so distant, but you instantly recognize something from it. Or perhaps it teaches you about something that might have something to do with your family, or maybe it teaches you something about a moment in the world that you never knew about, but you are excited by, and perhaps that glimmer of light will change your path of life. You know, art can be so meaningful for so many different people, and it's really for everyone. And to exclude anyone and to say that things are done in a certain way, I completely disagree with. It's about having your own approach and inviting as many people into this conversation as possible. And I think that's what Instagram does, and the internet. There is definitely a correlation between the rise of the democratization of art and the rise of the internet, because I think we're getting more and more people. If I think about the exhibitions dominating our galleries and museums today, it's more exciting than ever.
You indeed have started curating shows at galleries and museums, and curation itself is another part of the story. Who is the gatekeeper, and what are the principles they are operating to? How do you approach curating an exhibition? What will drive your decisions?
Well, it's a great question. I've curated many exhibitions in my life, and it's about the story that I want to tell at that specific time. You know, I remember in 2022, I curated a show with a fantastic artist called Deborah Roberts, who's based in Texas, and it was all about collage. What does collage mean in our contemporary society? From the way that we piece together so many different layers of our lives, perhaps we've lived in lots of different places, or perhaps we're piecing together an image, or the screens that we look at every single day are like a collage. How can we not envision modernity like a collage? That was really the sort of crux of that show. Other shows have been about the time that we're living in terms of the kind of the impact on movements like surrealism on our world now. You know, surrealism was a movement born in the 1920s that was really born out of a kind of absurd approach to what had happened in Europe in terms of the war. And in terms of crisis, people turned to the world deep in their head and the unconscious, because in a way, the real world was so unfathomable. And the world we're living right now, with everything's happening in Palestine, which everything that's happened in Ukraine, you know, in a way, the surrealists speak to me, because in a way, how can you fathom what's going on in these places, these treacherous things that are happening? And so in a way, we have to turn to something like surrealism to understand the moment we're living in. And then other exhibitions have been a celebration of artists who are working now, and, you know, just a way to unite threads between artists and to give them a space. And it's so exciting curating something, because it's almost like putting on a play. It's just sort of a sort of act of uniting together and telling a story through artworks.
Katie, thank you. It's a massive achievement, this work, going back to the book now, The Story of Art, Without Men, and including the women, finally. Thank you very, very much indeed. Thank you. Katie Hesse will be here for the Auckland Writers' Festival. She's appearing on the 18th of May, talking to the Auckland Art Gallery curator, Julia Waite, and the book is published by Penguin Random House.